thank you. So yeah, I'm going to talk about it's not your father's web anymore. I've been looking a lot about what's happening on the web right now, and I find it very interesting. So this is me, Jen Simmons on Twitter. I made the Bardic theme for Drupal 7, which actually, interestingly, sort of had its starting to actually happen here in Montreal. 2 years ago when I came to Drupal Camp, I hadn't met Angie yet, and she was, like, off walking around. And I knew who she was, so I was like, oh, Angie. And I had this idea for Bardic. John Alvin had been recruiting and sort of loudly talking to different people about doing a theme for Drupal 7, and so I had it all sort of in my head, and I went to Angie, and I'm like, Angie, hi. And I have this idea. So it was born, I guess, I don't know where we were 2 years ago, but it was born in the hall right out sitting next to... Yay! And then it, like, went in, I don't know, 18 months later. I work at Palantir.net. That's my day job. I work as a front-end developer officially, but I also do a lot of design and strategy. And I did the responsive design on the new Palantir.net website, which I'll talk about responsive design a bit later. I have a new podcast called The Web Ahead. I did a podcast for a while called The Daily Edition on the 5x5 Network with Dan Benjamin. And Monday I just launched a new podcast, which if you're interested in this talk, I highly suggest that you go check it out. That one little episode all by itself, it looks so lonely. So we're going to talk about the internet. Have a little stroll down memory lane. Probably most of you were not alive when the internet was started. I was 3 weeks old when the internet was started, back in 1969, long before the web. Of course, the web and the internet are two different things. A lot of people kind of think they're the same thing, but they really aren't. Also, I want to just give you a disclaimer. The things I talk about today, they don't mean that you have to go back to work on Monday and tell everybody that, oh my gosh, I learned about this new stuff. We have to stop everything right now, cancel the projects we're working on, and do everything completely differently now. That's not what I'm saying. The web is backwards compatible with itself. So whatever everybody's working on now is going to keep working for years into the future. The techniques and the methods that you use to build websites now, you're going to keep using them for quite a while. What fascinates me is what's starting to come up on the horizon. You know, we're driving down this road, and you can sort of see way down there this thing starting to emerge. So for those of you who are like, well, I don't want to go home and have to change everything. Like, you don't have to go home and change everything. it's just an idea about what's happening next. For those of you, because a lot of us are passionate, right? We want to, the reason you're in the web industry, say, versus some of these older industries, is because you like this exciting new frontiers. You like inventing things. You're interested in making, you know, that little button that you click and then somebody talks to you from Star Trek or whatever. Like little stuff. It's fun, right? So, all right, so the internet. This is, those are computers. computers, they didn't talk to each other at all. And they were very, very, very different from each other on a level that is very hard for us to imagine now. You know, they look like things like this, right? They were not designed to network. They had different hardware. They had different software. They had different operating systems. They had different ideas about how to build things. And they just didn't. There were no standards. There were no protocols. They didn't communicate with each other at all. So people got together, you know, talking about this, and they wanted to figure out how they could start making the computers have enough in common that they could start to talk to each other. So a vision came forward of like this, right? Let's get these computers connected to each other so we can do something besides sneakernet files from Cambridge to Stanford. Like, there's got to be a way. Isn't there a way we can get these computers to start talking to each other? Or really, you know, people wanted this kind of a thing where they could all talk to each other. And what people figured out back in the early days of the ARPANET days, ARPANET, is that it was going to be too hard to get the computers to talk to each other. So what they do is build this network of these computers that could talk to each other and then connect all the computers that could be connected up to that network would then connect to that network. And that was the launch of the ARPANET network, right? And that was hard. All that stuff was very hard to figure out. And ARPANET ended up looking like that. And this is funny to me because it's like, it's the United States. Like, MIT's over there, and Stanford's over there. Texas is down here. Utah and Illinois are up there. The early, this is in the early 80s. No, this is 77. And around the early 80s is when they started kind of phasing out the ARPANET and putting in the internet and replacing it. So the internet was used for a lot of different things, right? FTP. Like, just being able to log into another computer and get a file or put a file, retrieve a file, trade files back and forth instead of what? I don't know. Putting them in punch cards and putting them in the mail and waiting 2 weeks for them to arrive and then running them on the punch cards. Big deal. Remember anonymous FTP? Like, hey, this is cool. I'll just anonymously log into this other person's computer, roam around, and see what they have there for me. Like, that was when I was first getting online. That's what we still did. So BBS, bulletin board systems, email, Usenet, listserv, IRC, Gopher, these are all things that people use to use the internet, send information back and forth, text, a lot of it about text, a lot of it about sharing files or sharing programs back and forth. And a lot of it was about communication. Two people want to talk to each other, either in real time or in a separated amount of time. Like I put a message here on a bulletin board and somebody reads it later. Or I send somebody an email and they open it and read it later. Or we're here communicating back and forth in like an IRC right away, just immediately. Also, sometimes you communicated with people you knew and sometimes you communicated with strangers. But that was all about communication, right? Different kinds of ways to get stuff through. And this is Gopher. Gopher was really hot right before the web was invented or became popular. I'm not sure that it looked like this. This was still when it was kind of expensive to get online, so I wasn't on yet. But this is a 2008 screenshot of Gopher. But, it looks a lot like the web. There's an address up there at the top, and it's all gopher:// And it's a list with files, with links, right? You start to see the beginnings of things before the major internet. In the way that we know it today, or the web in the way that we know it today, people would join up in different, like, bulletin board systems. You would dial the phone number of that bulletin board, and you would log in, and you would be connected to that bulletin board. That's it. Not the whole web, just that bulletin board. And you'd do stuff there, and then you'd hang up the phone. And then maybe you call a different bulletin board, or you get through somewhere, you use some other service, and it would let you get to different places. All that took time. All that took, 20 years of evolution. So part of what was happening, as all of that was happening, is this concept of hypertext was emerging. In 1941, Lewis Borg created a hypertext-style novel, then Vannevar Bush, then Ted Nelson, big guy. And that was all in literature. That was in text on a piece of paper, not on a computer. This idea of linking one thing to another thing. The text itself could be hyper, that it could be broken into pieces, and you could read something and then go and read something else, and then that would give you some places to go, and you would go here, go there, this idea of nodes. It's interesting to me that it started culturally in the sort of computer science philosophy world or in the I'm a geek literature world, away from the machines, of just like, hey, this is this awesome modern new thing. It's going to revolutionize our brains. It's going to be fabulous. Did you guys ever read these? Anybody? A couple people. Choose Your Own Adventure books out in the 70s where you could, it would be like 2 pages of, okay, you're on a spaceship, and you hear this weird noise, and what are you going to do about that noise? Okay, you A, stir the tanks with a button, and B, go get out of your chair and go in the back and see what happens. See, so if you want to get up and go to your chair, go to page 27. If you want to push the button, go to page 12. And you would jump to that page in the book, and you would read that, and then you would have another choice and another choice. You would choose your own adventure. Which, by the way, if you're interested, I looked up the guy who, Edward Packard, who wrote the Choose Your Own Adventure series, has an iPhone app out where you can read the Choose Your Own Adventure books. And what I find really interesting is that this is it. He's not designing in 2011 the iOS sort of thing. He's sort of still back in that idea from the 70s and 80s of like, it's cool, look, this is how it works. $3.99. So then there was this program put out called Story Space, which, it's funny, if you go to graduate school, it's still talked about a lot, and people are still writing fiction in this way. But the idea was, in this, at the afternoon that a story came out in 1991, it was the first kind of literature published using the Story Space program. Very much a hypertext media, hypermedia project, where you would start out at the beginning and you would read a card and you would click and you would read another card. And the links were very obscure. It was very hard to see where the links were. They weren't underlined or anything. So you kind of had to just, like, click on the card, click, 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 click. Oh, look, that took me somewhere. And the story itself was very strange. You're not really sure what's going on. It's a story of a man who's seen a car accident, and it's almost as if he has disassociated from himself, and he's very confused, and he's very out of his body, and he's not really sure what's happening, and so you're not really sure what's happening. And you just get these little pieces and little poetry bits out of the corner of his eye, and you start to piece the story together as you get more and more of it. And you're never sure if you have the whole story, because there's no idea. You're not sure where you are in the map. It's very... So it was a big, exploration. Shelley Jackson put out a couple others, too, one called Patchwork. And then HyperCard. How many people ever use HyperCard? Yeah, a lot of... that was my first, For me, it was 1987. Came out... So Apple started shipping HyperCard with the Macs. It would come free with every Mac for a while. And you could play around with it to make these index cards. So you see the same idea again. Like, oh, there's index cards. And you can build them and click. This idea of a home. This is the home card with a little picture of a house, in case you weren't sure. And all these different things, like help, phone, calendar, HyperCal. And here, you could make a new button, and these are the maps. You would start to see these diagrams of, like, your stacks and how you're organizing your HyperCard project and where you're putting things. So people started really making stuff with this. And I don't know if it was officially the first, but it feels to me like a little bit... Instead of writing a program the way you would today in Objective-C for Mac or Java or whatever, you could just use this interface and click, 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 and make a little application of your own on top of this framework. So people did. There's this time saver to log your time, what you're doing. This is kind of a big... I think this is like an encyclopedia or a Bible or something, that all this information... word parts. People started playing around with making apps and making them out of this sort of, like, oh, it's the same stuff today. Bunch of information, let's organize it, or I need to add, I need to store some information, let me put it there. So this shape, right, the shape is used over and over again. A map of a hypertext web of connected articles. And that's really where the idea of the web came from, the word web, and why we ended up with this wide world web. It's a web that's all over the world. It's really awesome. The web. Strong Bad, this is hilarious if you haven't seen it. He's giving advice to somebody who's written him an email about what you need for a good website. He's suggesting animated GIFs and a Flash intro. So the web started, right? Web is 1991 as an idea and a listserv evolved. Around 94, 95, it really started taking off. And the basis of the web really is a link, an HTML connection, HTML and an HTTP connection. That's really, those things added up to the web. We got this language in which to mark up our pages. We've got this HTTP connection to send things through, and we link stuff, link it here to here to here to here. So what were we doing with the web when it started and for the next, 15 years? It was an easier way to do a lot of the same stuff. Gopher, email, bulletin boards all seemed to move over. All that stuff I named before sort of just went over to the web. Storytelling, this idea of broken up narratives and hypertext, people started doing that kind of a thing on the web. And desktop publishing online. So desktop publishing had always been a very analog, paper, physical. You take an X-Acto knife and cut things up and glue them back down and take a picture of it in order to make something for a printing press. right before digital technology. And then it switched all to, like, digital, digital, digital. So this idea was like, oh, well, let's just stick all that on the web, too. So brochures, brochureware, website that's my brochure. It's all the information about my company. It looked like this, right? Or actually, it looked like that, because the screens were really small. And at first, there was very little styling, very few images, maybe some, maybe not. And it was fluid, all fluid, right? And then we got this idea, especially coming over from desktop publishing, that we really needed, like, more visual control. So we used a lot of image slicing with the hot spots and the rollovers and the, like, remember in Dreamweaver and you cut stuff up and you're like, and work in one browser and not the other. And using tables to control, to fix the width of everything. And that's now been how we sort of do things. We switched to CSS, but this idea that it's a piece of paper is how we've worked for the last 10 years. Until now, recently, we're starting to go, maybe that's wrong. You know, we made these decisions based on this legacy. Maybe we want to rethink that stuff. Diagrams, right? This is, you know, IA, oh, my information architecture. Let's sit down and figure out where everything goes in our sitemap. This is kind of where we've gone. So this is how a website, you know, typically looked. Welcome to the www homepage for Syracuse University. Founded in, link, 1870. The university, blah, 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 blah. Schools and colleges is a link. There's no menu, right? This is kind of before. We didn't really come up with this menu user interface pattern until much later. And the idea of how do you find stuff on the web? Well, of course, you just have a giant card catalog. Over here is Dr. Cool Guy, who knows a lot of cool people. He's got his website. He's got a bunch of links on it. I go, I click, I find more stuff. Over here, we'll just have Yahoo will be this giant database of all the websites that someone manually, physically put into the system, and you get categorized under, you know, greetings, because Yahoo decided your website was in the greetings category. And so HTTP worked kind of like this, right? There's a server, there's a computer. The computer makes a request. It says, hey, I got this URL for me. Please go find the computer that has that website. And I need the index.html file. It goes, okay. And it sends it back to you. And then you make another request. You say, oh, I need this other thing. And it goes, okay, here it is. And you say, oh, I filled out a form. I got the data from the form. You want that data? It goes, okay. And it sends it back to you. Right? Like this is, and you just hope it goes, like, fast. And so maybe it will seem like this, but really it's like talking on a walkie-talkie. La 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 la. I'm done talking. Okay, this is what I have for you. Okay, I'm done talking. Right. It's not a real bi-directional connection. It's a one-directional connection. And that's very important because it shaped the web for 20 years. Because I could talk to this computer could talk to that computer and then that computer could say something back. But there's no It's not like IRC, where it's immediate, or Skype. If I'm on IRC and Angie types something, I see it. If I'm on the web and somebody added a comment, I have to refresh the page in order to get that comment to show, right? Unless you're using polling and there's long polling, but all that's sort of a workaround. So Web 2.0, the point kind of was like to find something, to read something, to look at images, to click on stuff, and you find more stuff and read more stuff, and that's what we did. Then Web 2.0 came along, and Web 2.0, we ended up with, rather than these files that were FTP to a server that we then request and get to see, you end up with magical robots who sit up there on the server with a database, and they assemble the website. You make the request, and the magical robots go, oh, hold on a second. They reach into the database, they grab the data, they build the page the way that it should be built, they send it back down. And it was very, very profound, a big, big deal to change it so that the database, you could add commenting, you could sign in, the users who use the website could add text and photos and stuff. You could buy things, you could participate. People started participating on the web rather than just reading the web. So the HTML, you know, from 90, 91 until 99, 2000, a lot of innovation. Four versions of HTML came along. Then from like 2000 to 2009, there wasn't a lot of innovation in that level of the metal, like that deep, that closer to the metal, like that particular level, not much changed. What changed is all these CMSs, all these different tools. How can we do these things better? How can we make these things easier? We figured out what we want to do with the web beyond a brochure. Let's build tools for it. And that's where Drupal fits in, right? Drupal is this pretty awesome CMS that lets you build this website without a lot of effort. to do all the kind of Web 2.0 kind of stuff. But things move. They keep going. They're moving along. So HTML5 adds a lot of stuff. HTML5 is not just markup. HTML, for a long time, it's really been about all those tags, those elements that you wrap content in. You know, a div, a paragraph, a head, H1, H2. And I think the thing that a lot of people don't realize about HTML5 is that it is a bunch of that stuff, like, oh, now we have a side, and now we have a fig caption. But it's also all of these APIs on the browser, in the browser, on the client side, APIs that are really quite powerful and do a lot of crazy stuff that we're used to thinking about servers doing, or we're used to just thinking is impossible, and we're preventing ourselves from thinking about all these ideas that are now you can do, because we're used to saying, well, you can't do that. You know, this is the web works. It's HTTP. It works like this. Or this is blah, blah, blah. And so there's some things that really break us out of that. One of them is storage. So database on the server side, you now have ways to store things on the client side. What we've been using is cookies, right? Cookies have been around for a long time. You can store something in a cookie on the person's computer. They're using their computer. They log in, for example. They restart their computer. They come back to the website. The website still knows they're logged in. That's because there's a little bit of data stored in a cookie locally on their machine. Cookies are really tiny. They need to be a small size so they can be attached to an HTTP request. They're not really meant to do a whole lot of crazy stuff. They're really meant just to serve this one function. So there are a lot of times when, you know, you're in a meeting and you're like, wow, blah, 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 can we do that with cookies? And people are like, eh. There's now about a bunch of other options. Web storage. So web storage is, it's also called DOM storage sometimes. There's two flavors, local storage and session storage. They're basically kind of the same thing. And they store key value pairs in the browser. So in the actual browser, you have a database that's two columns where you can store a key and a value on the person's computer. Session storage will hold that information for the session, and when the session is over, when the person closes the window, when they quit the browser, when they shut down their computer, it dumps that information. Local storage will keep it. It will keep it beyond a browser restart. The browser could crash, and the information is still there. They open up their browser, and that information is still there. So you can do a lot of things. You can store a lot of information in a database on the person who's using your website's computer. So maybe you're building something like Google Docs with a word processor, and they're typing, you know, someone's sitting there with their website, and they're typing, typing, typing. Instead of that information needing to somehow auto-save up to the database on the server, which requires that the person is online and requires that that connection is a solid connection, it can just store that information right there in the browser on that person's local computer. It's 5 megabytes just for the geeky details. It's typically a 5 megabyte cap. Just by default, you can have the user give you permission, give the site permission to store more. And then IndexedDB, there's a thing called, there's two different flavors of a more complicated relational database besides just a simple two-column table, two-column key-value pairs. WebSQL was the original idea, like, hey, let's make a SQLite database in the browser. That would be awesome. And then Mozilla came along, and they were like, we don't want to get married to SQL. That's too locked. That's too, you know, what if we don't want to do SQL? What if we want to do something else? So the WebSQL, basically it's in all the, it's not in IE and it's not in Firefox, but it's in Chrome, Safari, and Opera. So if you're making a website that's going to only work on iOS, because you're going to package it up as an iOS app and with PhoneGap or something, then you can totally use WebSQL. It's not going to go anywhere. But it's also never, ever going to be put into Firefox, and it's probably, I don't know what IE is doing. So there's this new one called IndexedDB. It's really much more complicated, and it's not really finished yet, but it will be awesome, and there'll be some tools to make it easier to use in the future. But basically, it's a crazy-ass database system if you want to build a real, relational, complicated database and have it work in someone's browser locally on their machine. You can use that. It's there for you. You use JavaScript to send things to it and from it and in and out of it and stuff. So here there's a demo, and you can see in the when you do inspect the web page down here, there's the database. And this is the I think this is a WebSQL database. If we had some local storage or session storage going on, you can see that here. And you can see the actual, like, oh, there it is. There's the data in the database. It really does change the possibilities of what you can do with a website. Application cache. This is another one. So you can offline cache a website. You can do part of it. You can do all of it. Basically, what you do as a developer, if you're a developer, is you make what's called a manifest file. It looks like, here's an example up here. It's very small. You type the word in a text file, cache manifest in capital letters, and then you make a list of all the files that you want to have the browser cache. So you can say, okay, when someone goes to the website, I want you to grab a copy of all of these files, download them, even if the user doesn't need them yet, and save them and keep them in that person's browser for me. And what happens, so like if you go to, I haven't hooked this up on jensimmons.com, but I will at some point. If you go to, so if I did, when you went to jensimmons.com, I could list all of the files in the entire website, all the HTML, all the CSS, all the JavaScript, so that when you hit the home page or whatever, the first page, what will happen is the browser will first load the what's needed, like normal. Like, oh, I'm looking at the about page, so let me load all the assets for the about page. Here's the about page. Oh, okay, now, oh, look, there's a manifest file. Let me read the manifest file and load everything else. So while the person's, like, reading that first page, the entire rest of the website starts downloading. And then when they click on another page, it's like, it's right there because it's already all downloaded. It's in the person's browser. They're no longer pulling it off the server. They're now pulling it locally. The idea with application cache is that you might build an application, like a game, that's all JavaScript and Canvas. Or maybe you build something like Google Docs and the word processor in Google Docs. Or maybe you build, I don't know, some app, something. And you want people to be able to use that application like as an application. And they, you know, they open up their laptop and they use your little, you know, Google Doc knockoff. And they're, all the stuff they're writing is getting saved in the database. And all the files that they need to run the website, the JavaScript, all that is saved on their computer. They're online. Then they close the lid. Then they go to their friend's house. Their friend's internet's down. They open it up. It can still work. Because the entire website is actually saved locally on their machine. So you can use it for an app like that, an application, or you can use it to speed up a website or to, you know, I mean, how many of us have, you like, especially when you're traveling, you open up like 6 tabs and you just very carefully place all the articles you want to read. And then you close the lid and then you go get on the plane and you're like, please still be there. Please, you know, open up the lid and you're like, okay, it's still there. I can read it now. But then there's a little link and you wish you could like go and read the second page or this can be used to sort of solve that problem where those things are actually on that person's computer rather than on the server. And then the third thing I wanted to talk about is WebSockets. So HTTP, right? One-way, one-directional connection, like a walkie-talkie. A socket connection, which you can use, instead of HTTP:// it ends up being WS:, or right now, really, you want to use WSS:// website address. This is why Chrome no longer displays the HTTP. Have you noticed that? Like, they don't... Google's doing all kinds of crazy stuff with the Chrome browser, where they're not necessarily using HTTP to send files around. They're using other things. And at some point, they just decided, let's just hide that beginning thing so people don't start freaking out when it says stuff like WSS, because you don't really know what protocol it's using. But you can, if you build a website, or if you're a business person or you're a designer, the website that you've helped plan, the people who are going to build it, they'll set it up so that it uses a socket connection. You need a socket server to serve this up. Because the entire internet doesn't know about WebSockets yet, it's a good idea to send it through a secure connection to WSS, which is WebSocket Secure, so that none of the routers and crazy stuff along the way are like, what the heck is that WSS? Stop. You know, or WS, stop, we're not going to let you through. Instead, it's like, I don't know what that is because it's secure, I can't see it. And it will send it through. But what you can do with a WebSocket then is open a real connection from one website to another website so that they can talk to each other. Two different people can talk to each other. Maybe they're on the same web page, and they can put something in, and it shows up automatically. Like Facebook. Have you ever tried to use Facebook chat? the chat little window in Facebook, like, it's crap, right? It's totally crappy, or it has been totally crappy, because they're using HTTP and polling. How many people around the globe have just a page for Facebook open, just hanging out at work, just open, and there's a little chat client down there? It's polling. You know how many servers Facebook must have to handle polling on every single web page ever? Because polling, for those of you who don't know, basically the little chat is sitting there in Facebook going, psst, you got anything for me? No? Okay. Psst, you got anything for me? No? Okay. So it will poll, I don't know what it is, it's probably a minute or 30 seconds or something, it takes a while. But then when you start using chat, it will speed it up, so then it will poll every half a second. But it's basically, it's like that HTTP, it's having to go, oh, you got a chat message for me? No, you don't. Do you have one? No, you don't. Do you have one? No, you don't. Where WebSockets, it would just be a real, it'd be like having IRC in the web browser, where it's just a real connection, and things when things happen in one place, they just show up in the other. Kazing is a company that's done a lot of work around WebSockets. Some of the people who run that company are the people who invented WebSockets. They have a WebSocket server that you can go and download and install. I don't know if it's GPL or what, but they got a bunch of stuff to get you started. A bunch of it's free. And this is a demo page that they have of, like, it's a crazy page. It's like, these are stock quotes. This is the headlines from the New York Times. Here's some the currency exchange and the numbers on the currency exchange. Like, all the different things they could think of why you might want to use WebSockets to just go ahead and update information in real time really quickly, automatically, without needing to have a server farm to handle polling for people. And then part of what makes WebSockets possible is this thing called cross-origin communication. So, and this, I know this is getting geeky. Some of you are like, yeah. Some of you are like, meh. But, but the one of the things that's really kind of tough about wanting to do these things, oh, look, two different websites talking to each other, is that we, in the original web, there was no, like, anonymous FTP. Like, oh, anybody can just FTP into my website, my server. It'll be awesome. They're cool. Right? Now you're like, no, get away. Don't come onto my server. You're being attacked by spam robots. So one of the things that we, of course, as Drupal developers, you know this, like, you have to constantly be careful of cross-site attacks. That there's some spam robot is going to come and try to fill out the comment form on your website with some malicious PHP. And if you let them, the malicious PHP or malicious JavaScript, the JavaScript will run and it will destroy the planet and your web server will go down. So you have to constantly protect against all these different problems that could happen by saying, I don't know who you are, no. I don't know who you are, no. Get away. Everybody get away from me. No one can talk to me. So cross-origin communication is a whole other bunch of APIs and stuff that is a system where you as a developer can say, yes, you can come over here. Yes, I like you. We can talk. It's identifying domains. It's identifying, like, subdomains and domains and the little .com or whatever extension on the end. It's recognizing those and it's saying, okay, as Drupal.org, I'm allowed to talk to association.drupal.org, and I'm allowed to talk to, and you can have websites talk to each other and make traffic happen. So socket connection can go from one domain to a different domain because there's a whole security protocol that's going to work and make it possible and not have to constantly throw up all these walls the way that we have been. And then responsive design. How many people know what responsive design is? So here's, mobile, like awesome, mobile. We've been designing, we started out like, oh, we got a 28.8, or I started, I don't know, other people started out at 14.4 or 9600 or anybody, 1200, was that like the, yeah, so. But there was an era where we were like, okay, my users all have a 28.8K modem, and all their screens are 600 by 400, and all of them use a keyboard and a mouse. I know this, because, of course, everyone's like me. And then we were like, okay, wait, everybody's got a 56.6, and their screens are 800 by 600, and, of course, they still all can use a keyboard and mouse. There's no disabled people ever in the world. They don't exist. And then we're like, oh, this is awesome. Everybody's got DSL now, and they got 1024 bytes. This is not true. This is never been true. But because we're in this habit, the new habit is, oh, now we got two kinds of people. We got people who have Fios, and we have people who have 3G. And all the Fios people have 1020, they have giant monitors, these big giant monitors, and they all use a keyboard and mouse. And then all the people on 3G have 320 by 40, and they're using a touchscreen. There's only two kinds of people in the world, those are them. Right? We're going to make a regular site for the people on the left. We're going to make a mobile site for the people on the right. People never use their laptops on a 3G connection tethered in an airport. Mm-mm. People never have a modem because they live in Idaho, and the 56.6K baud modem is like as good as it ever got there. No one's, you know, of course, people are using all sorts of different devices. They're using assistive technologies to get to their computers, to their websites. They have all kinds of different size screens. So we got Fios cable, DSL satellite, dial-up, 4G, 3G, and Edge. Remember Edge? You know, if you live in New York, you're basically 3G is Edge half the time. San Francisco as well. Got all these different widths. We've got all these different kinds of devices for getting information into the computer and getting information out of the computer. So responsive design is a way to live in that reality and to say, okay, we're going to go ahead. And there's more, there's a lot to it. Mobile first, content first, users first, thinking about what do your users really want to do on the website. Let's deliver that information to them, not 300 words of text surrounded by ads, really flashy, special ads. Like, let's give them what they want. And let's use CSS to make the layouts change as the screen size changes. So on Palantir.net, gosh, that's blurry. Here, you know, you can see five people across, three people across, one person across. As you can grab the corner of the web browser, and as you squish the web browser, it changes size. So if tomorrow the Amazon announces a Color Nook tablet that has a really great web browser in it, and it's, I don't know, 550 wide or 727 wide or 902 pixels wide. Like, this screen is already designed to sort of fit onto that size. This website is designed to fit onto that size screen, no matter what it is. Because we can't keep up. You cannot keep up with the number of devices that are coming out right now. So a great approach. When it's not, doesn't work all the time. It's not a magic bullet. There's times that you do want a mobile site. There's times when you do want a mobile app. There are times when you want more than one website. But you can do a lot, especially a site like this. You know, it's a typical, here's our web shop. This is what we do. This is who we are. There's a lot you can learn about responsive design. So, what can you do with this stuff? WebSockets, web storage, storing things in the browser, responsive design. I think it's kind of exciting because I feel like we've been in a habit of building sites in a certain way for a really long time, and we've gotten better and better and better at it. But we're at this moment where what a website is really going to change. And 5 years from now, we'll look back and we'll say, much of the way we did once Web 2.0 sort of took off, and we look back at the Web 1.0 websites and we're like, hey, that's so old. That's so, you know, 1999. So, for example, I was supposed to present in Houston for the Southwest Drupal conference, and I got snowed in by a blizzard in New York, so I didn't make it there. So Angie took her computer and opened it up and, brought Skype up, and I basically did my presentation via Skype, which got me audio, and I sent the slides across the video, but, like, I have a really bad upload speed in New York because I have stuck with Time Warner, and so I would, like, change the slide, and it would, like, take forever to change it. That's not what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was basically have the slides. I mean, I guess I could have emailed the keynote presentation, and then Angie could have, like, clicked the button. But what would have been awesome is, have you seen a lot of people do HTML slides instead of using Keynote? Like, their whole slide system, their whole slideshow is a website, right? You could do that with WebSockets, where I could have been in New York looking at the web page with the slideshow, and then someone, Angie, could have in Houston opened up the website with the slideshow and then displayed that web page on the screen, and then I could have sat in New York and hit next slide, and the web page in Houston could have just changed automatically, right? That kind of stuff, like, oh, that's, Really? You can do that? Like, it just, boom. I do something in that web page. You don't have to touch the web page. You don't have to refresh it. You don't have to do anything. I click the button over here. It changes over there automatically. Games. A lot of developers are into games. A lot of developers are the people who really understand this at this point, and the designers don't really know so much about it yet. So one of the topics of conversation, besides the stock quotes and the currency exchange data kind of changes, that people talk about is games. So you could have two people in two different cities playing the same game, multiplayer, and the, you know, whatever, you turn right over here and it shows that your character shows up on the other person's screen having turned, and they do something over here and it shows up on your screen having turned, and the score information goes back and forth. The scores could be stored locally instead of having to hit the server. Just both parties have all of the data, the whole website already on their computer, all the JavaScript already on their computer, and, you know, just the WebSockets can make that sort of instantaneous connection that goes between the two. The kind of stuff that people have been doing with, I guess it's Xbox and different gaming platforms where you can do multiplayer across a network connection. But you can't do that. In the past, you couldn't do anything like that with a website. I mean, websites, they're just supposed to be brochures, right? You're supposed to have a brochure page. It really makes it more dynamic. Like, oh, it's a space. There's a space and there's a space and there's stuff happening and it can happen in both places at the same time. Another thing like DrupalCon Chicago, a group of people at Palantir built a mobile app for DrupalCon Chicago. And so we had the DrupalCon website, which was also built on COD. It's built very much like, oh, it's a website, a traditional website. But it had a feature where you could do the My Schedule, and you could save the My Schedule stuff, right? Then we made a web app, a phone app that worked on Android and iOS. We didn't do a tablet because of time. The idea was, okay, you open it up with your phone. A lot of the original data of the schedule, all the sessions, all the bios, and any bio presenter pictures that were already available were packaged up in the app when the app went to the store. But when you downloaded the app and opened it up, it would ping the server and get any updates. So if somebody's presentation title had changed, or a presenter had changed their bio, or someone had added a picture to their bio, the app would then go get that data and like replace it, and the app would be updated, right? We wanted to do integration with the My Schedule as well. We just didn't have the time. So that you could do My Schedule on the website, and then get the app and do the My Schedule on the app, and then, right? If we wanted to, we could use, now, instead of making an app, just make one website. Make the website change sizes and shapes for different devices so that on a big screen it's big, on a little screen it's little, so that you can use the real website on your phone without a lot of trouble. Then use the application cache, offline app cache, to basically download the entire website into your phone so you have the whole schedule in your phone with all the assets and all the bios, pictures, and all the everything, all of it. Not just the schedule, but like the whole website on your phone. And then use local storage for any sort of My Schedule functionality. Now, the tough thing is the syncing. Like, well, if you change it on your phone and you change it on your computer and they're both offline and then you get online and all the information goes back to the server, like, what do you... If you want to know what a really good career move is going to be, if you like this stuff, learn syncing. Like, 5 years from now, it's going to be like, yes, I do know how to sync and my rate is... Because people are going to want to sync local stuff to server stuff, and it's syncing is really, really hard. But it's just a different idea. Like, oh, maybe we didn't need an app at all. We could have just taken the whole website and made it work and that would have given us iPad as well, or tablets right out of the gate as well. Then it almost becomes a marketing decision. Like, it's kind of cool to have it in the store versus just click save to home screen button on your thing. And people, users don't expect it. They expect that if they go to a website and then they get offline that they're stuck. You're traveling internationally, you don't want to use a data plan. You just sort of assume that, well, too bad for me. When if the site uses offline caching, it's not too bad for you. The whole site's still there. Even if your phone crashes and you restart, the whole site will still be there. So does that make sense? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities. So where can you learn more? This particular stuff, this geeky API database stuff, there's a book called Pro HTML5 Programming that Peter Lubbers and friends have written. And there's a coupon code. There's an ebook. And if you want to get the ebook for 50% off, There's a coupon code if you go to 5x5.tv/web-ahead/1, which is the page for episode 1 of the Web Ahead. There's a coupon code on there for 50% off the ebook through the end of the month. You can go to the spec itself, of course, if you want to get into the details. This is where all the details are. You want to know what the canonical real thing is. You've read all these blog posts. You're confused. You can always go read the spec. Or you can go read the other spec. the spec, this is, the W3C has a spec, and the WhatWig has a spec. This spec is kind of the official, done and dusted HTML5. This is what we've all agreed we're going to do. The WhatWig is more of a working group trying out new ideas. They've stopped calling it HTML5, and they changed the name to HTML the Living Standard, which, you know, of course, is so cool. HTML the Living Standard! Which basically means it's HTML5 plus whatever is going to end up in HTML6 and 7, and there's stuff in here that, you know, may not be, it's not in HTML5 because it's HTML6. They're both cool. They're both, Ian Hickson controls both of them, so they're both, like, he has commit access to both, so it's all one group of people. There's this website, Dive Into HTML5. With a lot of great information. It also got put into a book if you want to read it in kind of book form. A lot of great kind of more basic explanations of things. HTML5 Rocks is a fairly new site that Google put up that's got tons of tutorials and lots of geeky deep information to kind of walk you through just individual specific things. Like, how do I use offline caching? Let me just get the tutorial for how to do that. Can I Use is a great website for... You know, you're wondering, like, can I use this yet? Here we've got web storage, right? Name, value, pairs. Look at all that green. Green means you can use it. It's supported in IE8, local storage and session storage. The only thing you would need to worry about is if you've got a lot of IE7 users, they're not going to get stuff stored, so you got to do something for them, some sort of polyfill or some sort of, you know, fallback that the site's going to function a little differently for them. If you stop caring about IE7, then you're done. And also, though, Opera Mini doesn't do anything. Opera Mini takes photographs of your website on a server somewhere and sends the photographs to the phone of the person who's using it. It is the most popular mobile browser. I mean, all these people have these phones, these little phones, right? They get on the web. It looks totally funny because what happens is the website, the HTTP request, doesn't send the files to their phone. It sends the files to some Opera Mini server. Opera Mini server basically takes a giant picture of that page and sends the picture, compresses it, and sends the picture to the phone. And it doesn't send you, like, the real page. It, like, reinterprets it. It strips off some stuff and it rearranges everything. All the more reason that responsive design and that kind of approach is a good approach. This site is great for knowing what's going on with IE, Firefox, Safari, Chrome, and Opera for desktop computers, for laptops and towers. This mobile is sort of weak because just saying, oh, yeah, it works on Android. Android is the new IE. there's like 27 bazillion versions of Android. So it's not a Boolean. It's not a yes-no question. So Quirks Mode, PPK, Peter Paul Kosh over at quirksmode.org, he's gotten really into mobile and, like, what's up with mobile. And he, so, like, here... You can't read that. Opera Mobile, Opera Mini, iPhone, Android, Symbian, BlackBerry, Palm, Bolt. Like, browsers you've never heard of. He's collecting phones. It's just a hobby. As many phones as he can get. And then he's very scientifically figuring out all these different tests and stuff and then filling in these giant charts of, you know. So this is local storage here. You know, it doesn't do IE Mobile, BlackBerry, or whatever that says. And here, like, here's media queries, which is a big part of what makes responsive design work. You know, media queries, look at all that green. Beautiful. And this is, oh, here, he's got a separate page. It's funny. We all really wish that you could open up Safari on your Mac and test a website and be done and be like, woohoo, it works in WebKit, it must work in everything. There are 24 versions of WebKit. WebKit's an open source project. People fork it. So he's basically made a giant chart of, like, You know, you can't just say it works in WebKit because, like, here's app cache. No, yes, no, no, yes, no, no, yes, yes, yes. So if you want to know more details about mobile, it's a good site to go to. And then, of course, Google. Google. People are writing tutorials like crazy. And I'll pimp my show one more time, The Web Ahead. The first episode is all about local storage and offline caching and WebDB, IndexedDB, with Peter Lovers, who knows the technical details of what servers are doing far more than I do. And that's me, again. So we have, like, 9 minutes for questions if we want to do a few questions. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what Drupal... It's interesting. A lot of this stuff happens deeper in the stack than Drupal or further away from the stack from Drupal. So, you know, Drupal is a part of the layer. You could build a Drupal website with WebSockets, for instance. If you're building websites for the New York Stock Exchange and you want to do a display of stock quotes, you could totally build it as a Drupal site and then use a WebSocket server to come along and fill in those stock quotes, because it's not really integrated with the content management system. You might need a way to, like, how do I get that block on the page kind of thing that we do with Drupal all the time. But and then some of it's, you know, some of it's all front-end, it's CSS, JavaScript, some of it's, like, server stuff. But as far as the kind of middle layer of, like, what can Drupal, I think it's up to the community to figure out, to say, you know what, maybe we should build into, we got this thing compressing our JavaScript, we got this thing compressing our CSS, maybe we want to build the app cache file, for example, when you make that manifest file, you have to list every URL. There's no, sites, all themes, images, star. You've got to list every single image. Boilerplate has a robot that will make that file for you, the HTML5 Boilerplate project. Someone could make that as a contrib module for Drupal of, like, hey, you want to use offline caching? Here's a module. Configure what you want to do, and this robot will build the manifest file for you. Or I just think around performance, there's a lot. Performance is a big concern. I think there's some real opportunity to figure out performance. Or maybe syncing. Maybe the Drupal database, somebody wants to figure out how to architect a system so the Drupal database can sync with local storage and session storage. And I don't know. No. Yeah. I mean, I went to dinner with Peter and learned all about data URIs, which is another thing I didn't talk about, but it's a way to make images into long strings of text. And, like, I went back and talked to Eric Duran and Nikki Stevens about it, and they were like, woohoo! And they went and made the faster image module, that night. So that kind of stuff has, but I don't know. I don't know, it's still so new. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the question, with responsive design, the idea, like on the Palantir website, if you go to a portfolio page that's showing off a, hey, we built this website, it's awesome. The picture for doing that is pretty big. I think if you stretch your browser really big, it's probably about 800 pixels wide. So if you're looking at that page on a mobile device, that image isn't being displayed at 800 pixels wide, it's being displayed at 300 pixels wide. So why do you need the 800 pixel wide? Why do you need to download all that data, right? So this is not just a Drupal problem, this is a problem in the, it's interesting, puzzle in the front-end development community that's being dealt with. The Boston Globe, which just launched on Monday, if you haven't seen it yet, go to the bostonglobe.com new website. It's a really crazy, cool, responsive design site. They're using a technique where, yeah, it's downloading the mobile image first, and then it's lazy loading in. It's like maybe it's using WorldFold to detect the device, or maybe it's, hopefully not. Hopefully, it's detecting the screen size, and then if you have a bigger screen, it will like go grab the bigger image for you. It seems like that's the ideal, and I know that John Albin Wilkins, who works at Palantir, built the Zen theme. he's working on a solution for Drupal. Because Drupal already has this whole system of, like, image styles and, like, recutting all your images to these different sizes. Like, what if you could recut it to 3 sizes and then have JavaScript make a decision about which size to load? That would be ideal. But I also feel like what I've done is I've seen people who say, well, we can't do responsive design yet because we don't want to download all the big images. So let's just build a big website with all the big images. And I'm like, wait, you're downloading the 800K image anyway. Like, let's just build the site so it responds, and we shrink the 800K image down. It's not great. But you know what? It's like there's only one of those on the page, and then there's a bunch of little ones. And so we cut the little ones. I just cut everything to the maximum that was needed and nothing bigger. And I designed it so that like it didn't have a ton of huge images, you know, so that the whole page isn't that much. But you pay attention to what the Filament Group is doing and what Ethan Marcotte is doing, and there's a couple other people who are involved with the Boston Globe project to like find that's one of the things that in 2 years we'll have a solution for that. Well, you can, yep. It's a trade-off, right? You got to think of what, yeah. Another question? Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. You should check out the Workbench project and the Media module. That it's completely unrelated to what I just talked about, but those two projects are working on that. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, you could ask Angie at lunch. I don't know. There's actually a media sprint happening right now. I think it's right now. Yeah. The Palantir is doing. Next week. I don't know, whatever. I don't know. I'm going to Chicago on Sunday, so tomorrow. Yeah, back there. So the question was the question was about WebSockets and some more the technical details of what happens. What I do know is that a WebSocket it's just an open connection, and it starts across HTTP. It actually uses HTTP to get going, and then it like turns into WebSockets, so that you don't have to worry about firewalls. It still goes across the old ports and stuff so that we don't have a big problem trying to run around getting enterprise people to open up ports. But once the connection is open, you can do anything you want with it. So I guess you could send through C++ through. I mean, it's funny, the new edition, the new Chrome that just came out, runs C++, the browser does. It runs C and C++. And I was like, why? But maybe it's because some people can write C programs and have them go through the WebSocket. You have to do something with a socket, so you have to be able to program whatever to go through that socket. As far as the details, I have no idea. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I love thinking about this stuff from the perspective of a designer and the CM and a CMS, but not, I don't know. And I probably won't ever. But other people do. Peter Levers does. Yeah, and there's tons of information out there to be had. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Socket. The question about Socket.io. Socket.io, I believe, is a polyfill to let people use WebSockets in older stuff. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Degrade to polling. If you wanna use it now. Yeah, that's all I know. That's what I know. That's, yeah. I don't know. Good luck. I'm not a sysadmin, so I don't know. I like knowing what it does. I don't like knowing how to do it. Yeah, but because this stuff is so exciting and because so many people are working on it, there are new kind of open source JavaScript polyfill just springing up every day. So look and ask and contact people directly. They're just as easy to reach in the wider community as they are in the Drupal community. So thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.